Right then, action.
Hello, I'm Simon Mercer, and welcome to Crave, the podcast dedicated to music, movies, and anything else that's been entertaining me and Steve McCabe lately.
Now, this week, we've got a seriously good examination of America's racial divide, courtesy of probably the only person who could truly do it the kind of justice that it got in this film, Spike Lee. His latest film is Black Klansman, and among other outstanding talent, it's got the son of Denzel Washington.
Yes. Didn't you think he sounded like his dad at times?
Do you know, it looks nothing like him, but as soon as he started talking, I thought, good Lord, that's Denzel's lad, isn't it?
I know, it was really interesting to hear him.
Yeah.
Anyway.
And I think he's also got some of his dad's talents too, but we'll come to that later.
We'll come to that. Unfortunately, not all the movies are good this week, because Steve and I have suffered through a film which perhaps had a good idea lurking somewhere within it, but that idea was not realised. We're talking about The Happy Time Murders.
No, there was a good idea in there, but it was very thoroughly buried, wasn't it?
Oh, I know. Talk about not delivering on what could have been something that was good. I mean, anyway, we'll come back to that.
We will talk about it at great length, Simon. Yeah.
Yes, yes.
So what else will we talk about? Oh, that's right. Yeah, you've been talking to a fellow that I've heard referred to as the best musician you've never heard of. Now, you've heard now of Stephen Wilson, haven't you? The English prog rocker who's bringing us, seriously, a 3-hour sound and vision show to Auckland later this year.
That's right. Yeah, I had an interview with him just a few days ago, and we'll be listening to that a little bit later in the podcast. He's an interesting guy, and interesting to hear him talk about matters not only to do with music. But we will have one other musical item on our agenda, and that is young Mr. McCabe. I can just call you young, Steve. You're going to report on a show from an artist who we have heard of, without doubt, namely Pink, who also had a show, I think, quite heavily laden with sound and vision, I believe, at Auckland Spark Arena.
It was quite the spectacular. It truly, truly was. But let's start at the movie, shall we? Shall we start with the pictures?
Yes.
We'll start about a black and white film. I know.
Correct.
In many ways, it is. It's about the black and white, the sharp divide that is America's bitter, bitter race history. And so, like I say before, Spike Lee's probably the only fellow who could truly do justice to it. And as you've remarked, Simon, quite appropriately, it's a black comedy. Well, we can do these gags all night, can't we?
I know.
But they're all relevant. It is a very, very bleak comedy. When it is funny, it's bleakly, hideously, darkly funny. But there's drama and there's tension attached to it. Black Klansman. What did you make of it, Simon?
Yeah, it is really good. And it's based on a true story, what's more. It's about how in the late 1970s, a guy called Ron Stallworth became the first black man to join the police force in the city of Colorado Springs.
Yeah, he ends up joining their undercover department, doesn't he? And infiltrating, of all things, the local chapter of the Ku Klux Klan.
And the film follows that story. Stallworth is played by John David Washington, yes, son of Denzel. His fellow undercover cop, Flip Zimmerman, that's a Jewish name in case you didn't guess, is played by Adam Driver. We've got Topher Grace, who I think it was a bad guy in one of the Spider-Man films not that many years ago. He plays the KKK national leader, David Duke. We've got some pretty good turns from other actors too. Jasper Parkinen plays the local KKK hothead called Felix, and his wife, Connie, is played, I thought, very well by an actress called Ashley Atkinson. We've even got a couple of sort of guest appearances, Steve. Harry Belafonte and Alec Baldwin turn up. Mm. So there's a lot of talent on show. It's as you said, very black, pretty cutting. That's the summary of it. Let's get going with where it works and where it doesn't, if it doesn't.
Well, the setup you've just given is pretty fair. You've got this bizarre story. And again, it's worth pointing out at the very start, as Spike Lee in one of his captions points out, this joint is based on some for real stuff. And it's bizarre to think that this actually happened. So you've got this incredible situation where Ron Stallworth is in the position of being the first black man in the police department in Colorado Springs in the 70s. That in itself beggars belief. But there he is. Yeah. And so he's managing to infiltrate the Klan, and he does this basically by doing it over the phone. He calls up and says he wants to join. And by the time he realizes he's in, it's too late. He's kind of stuck. So he ropes in his partner, Flip. And so you're pointing out that Zimmerman's a Jewish name wasn't just a gratuitous bit of Jew spotting there. The point is that you've then got also, even though it's not pointed out quite so pointedly in the title, you've got a Jewish fella who actually attends meetings playing the part of Ron Stallworth.
Yes.
And it's bizarre.
It is bizarre. Of course, he's pretending to be a black man and hiding his Jewishness because the Ku Klux Klan can't stand the Jews either. So it's an utterly bizarre story.
To their credit, they were always equal opportunity bigots.
Yeah, correct. And I think it is such an interesting story that alone draws you in, doesn't it? You're not quite sure where this story is going to take you. And so as a piece of screenplay and writing, it's great. It's a really interesting story in itself. And in its treatment, I thought the time setting was interesting, Steve. That we're talking about the late 1970s, well before social media and the internet, and perhaps looking back now, that it all seems a little naive. And even the detectives, Ron Stallworth is played by Washington. You know, he gives his real name out. That leads to problems about the KKK possibly being able to track him down. You know, we're not talking about a sophisticated operation, are we?
No,
and that's
not
part
at all.
Of what's the charm of the story in a sort of a way. Similarly, the KKK are not an sophisticated lot either. So that gives it that sort of sense of this could probably happen because it's all a bit of bumbling around and this is just how real life is. I thought that was very well handled.
It was, and you mentioned a couple of the actors who played the hardcore of the local Klan chapter, and one thing that the film doesn't flinch from, and it couldn't, if it wants to be an honest depiction of the events, they depict the language used by these fellas quite viciously. I mean, obviously, if you want to depict people who hate black people, you have to talk about. You have to put words in their mouths that talk about black people in extremely offensive terms. And so you've got Adam Driver, who is being required to act like he sympathises with these idiots, spouting the most profoundly obnoxious, vicious venom against blacks and Jews in order to demonstrate his supposed good faith as a member of the Klan. So, I mean, it can't have been comfortable for Driver. The opening sequence with Alec Baldwin, who's playing some sort of deluded professor, doing a film narration talking about the inferiority of the black man, and I'm thinking, dear Lord, I know he's acting, I know this is what actors do, but it must have been difficult even just to mouth those words, because that's how offensive it gets.
And of course, John David Washington playing the real Ron Stallworth on the phone.
Yes. Yeah, he's also called upon to spout some particularly foul and obnoxious comments about black people, which must have been an interesting challenge for Washington.
Yes, exactly. So, I mean, that's where the black comedy comes in, forgive the phrase. It's kind of, there's a bizarre element to it, isn't there?
It's very, very odd. It can't have been comfortable to make.
No, I think, I was trying to think of this film. I thought it was thoroughly enthralling, obviously extremely pertinent to events still in current day America. And one question, it doesn't really detract from the film necessarily, but it did strike me, Steve, that you've got not only the white local Ku Klux Klan in Colorado Springs, we also get to meet a group of local young black students who are protesting in favor of black rights.
Yes.
And we're stereotypically portrayed. It's very effective in the telling of the story. It's, this is such a stark contrast, but the nuances are explored in the characters of Ron Stallworth and Zimmerman. I think that they're the writers spend a bit more time in with them, because neither of them are really radical guys to start with, are they? I mean,
no.
Stallworth isn't. He meets an attractive woman. He gets attracted to from the student group, but he doesn't really buy into her radical student protest type activities. And similarly, Zimmerman, even though he's having to confront his Jewish or hide his Jewishness when he infiltrates the KKK, he said, I never really thought about my Jewishness very much. It doesn't never really bothered me. So they've allowed those characters to be a little more nuanced and allow some of the themes of the movie to play through them, whereas on either side you've got some more starkly entrenched characters on the far black and white side of the debate, if you like.
No, so I hadn't picked up on that watching the film, but yeah, you do make a good point, which is a shame because you know there is some cracking acting on both sides.
Yeah, no, there is. I mean, I think that you don't. In a way, it's hard to watch actors, as you said before, embracing racism like that. But the guys who do play the KKK do it in a way that you think you're angry at them and you kind of feel angry at them and sorry for them at the same time because they're so ignorant and naive and just straight out prejudiced. But of course, that means they're doing a good job with their acting.
Yeah, I mean, like I say, if you're going to depict that kind of bigotry, then you can't pull the punches. This is how these people spoke. This is how you have to depict them as speaking. I mean, I can't say enough good things about John David Washington. Denzel must be very proud of his young lad, because clearly the talent's in the genes. That's pretty obvious.
Yep.
I've never been much of a fan of Adam Driver, I have to be honest.
I remember you saying that in the previous podcast. I actually enjoyed his performance in this film, I have to say, Steve.
I think I'm starting to see what the fuss is all about.
Okay.
This one did it for me. I think it's a role he was better suited for. I mean, last thing I saw him in, he was like Darth Emo in, Star Wars. And I didn't care for that at all. Did you see Patterson?
No.
Debbie, our intrepid guest reviewer, says it was absolutely brilliant.
Okay.
But then she's an Adam Driver fan, to be fair.
Okay. I just on this issue of stereotyping and whatnot, I even before we get to the end of I'm not going to spoil it for people, but there's a particular sequence at the end of the film which gives the film a different flavor right at the end, and it takes you away from the story that is being told about what happened back in the 70s.
I know the scene you're talking about. Yes,
and it certainly is very effective. But I couldn't help thinking that it made the film a more overt piece of anti-racist propaganda. And in a way, I didn't need it. I mean, I thought the story is so interesting about what happens with Ron Stallworth. And in the way they wrote the story, there are enough references to America, you know, what the white racists thought of a pure America, that you didn't – some pretty clear signposts bringing you to what's going on today.
It was a bit on the nose in places, actually, yes.
Yeah, it was. And so I thought the sequence at the end, very hard-hitting, but I don't know if I needed it. How did you feel about that?
You're talking about the storytelling sequence toward the end, aren't you?
I'm talking about some footage, some actual footage.
Event. Clearly, Spike Lee decided that he really, really wanted to make the point, and he didn't care how uncomfortable it made people feel. This point was damn well going to get made, and I can see why he would want to do that.
Yes, I think that's true, and I think he achieved that. All I'm saying is, you can look at a film and be drawn into its story, right, and the drama of it, and you can learn, and you absorb the lessons that this piece of drama is telling you.
Yes.
But then he goes a step further and knocks you over the head with a political point that was, I think, there anyway. And I thought it slightly detracted from how good the actual story of the main movie was in a sort of a funny way.
And yet,
I'm being a bit picky, but
I'm going to put myself inside the head of Spike Lee here, which is a brave thing to do, obviously. I'm going to suggest that he doesn't really care how discomforted you and I were by that. And I think that's probably he was looking for that.
No, quite right. Fair enough.
But I think you're right. I mean, it does very slightly shift the tone of the film. I think the moment for me that slightly lost it, that's too strong a word, was at the end. There is a credits sequence, a closing credits sequence of live action footage from the present day.
That's what I'm referring to.
Right, okay. I was thinking something a little bit earlier. Right.
Ah, okay. Yes.
Of an, so earl, an earlier film. Yeah, we're trying so hard to avoid spoilers here, Simon. We're talking
about each other. Yeah, we're confusing each other. Never mind.
No, you make a good point. Yeah, but even so, I think that probably Lee would say, I don't care how uncomfortable you were. I'm damn well making this point. It's a point that needed making, and hey, it's his film. I don't think anyone gets to tell Spike Lee what to do.
No, no. And I wouldn't want that to detract from the overall impact of this film. I think it's really a great, great story. It's an uncomfortable story, but it's a really interesting story. It's really well told, really well acted. It really draws you in. And it's one of the best films I've seen this year, I'd say. So I'd highly recommend it. And I'd pay the price of it to see it.
So absolutely. I mean, that's a film that I think we both wholeheartedly recommend. Now, how about a film that we're going to give a less resounding endorsement to?
Indeed. Yes. Yes, indeed. This is a film called The Happy Time Murders. And it's a film with adults and Muppets in a world together, set in Los Angeles. It's sort of purporting to be one of those L.A. crime noir sort of, you know, Sam Spade type stories.
Yes.
But it's set in the modern day. It's a spoof of that, and it's meant to be a comedy, but it's clearly also trying to draw some messages about prejudice, in this case against Muppets, but about how two different species are trying to coexist. So there is an attempt. And at times it's quite a serious attempt to make it a message movie in a way. And I think that's the problem with it, because it's trying to be both an outrageous comedy and a story with some pathos. And I think it fails to do both. And as a result, it's a bit of a mess, in my opinion. I think the comedy was crass and not always very funny. In fact, very rarely funny. And the drama was a bit boring.
Yeah, I mean, it had so much potential. Like, I mean, the setup you mentioned, which, you know, hard on the heels of a very, very, very well done race relations film. You know,
yes.
It's about the only point of contact between this and Black Klansman I can think of. You've got this very, very flimsy idea of a TV show called The Happy Time Gang, which is this sort of saccharine sitcom starring a bunch of, you know, puppets. They're never named as Muppets.
No, they're not.
Even though we've got another son of celebrity, you know, the director was Brian Henson.
Son of Jim.
Jim's one. And Jim is rolling in his grave as we speak.
In fact, also just on that quickly, one of the executive producers is Lisa Henson, who is a daughter of Jim Henson. So the Hensons are right in this, and they should have known better.
They really need to have a quiet word with themselves, don't they? Because you've got this idea about, you know, this sitcom about a bunch of puppets, and one by one they're getting murdered, and so you've got Melissa McCarthy as Detective Connie Edwards, and then you've got an interesting little piece of casting. Now, what's the fellow's name? I had his name on my screen, and
Bill Barretta.
That's your man. Thank you. Yes,
Bill Barretta played her partner. Yes. Or her former partner. Yes.
Phil Phillips, who once was a police puppet.
Yes.
Who blew a shot and accidentally killed a civilian and got kicked out of the force as a result. And they're put back together to try and solve the Happy Time murders. And all they managed to do is murder a happy time at the cinema. Because like you said, there's one scene of puppet sex that's in one of the trailers.
Yes.
That gives a very misguided view of what the film's like. Because it's a serious, gross-out piece of comedy.
Mm.
Now, did you ever see Team America World Police?
Yes, I did. Yes. Now, there's a sex scene in that too, isn't there?
But that one's funny.
Yes.
That one's very, very funny. That entire film is hysterical because it knows...
Not funny at all.
Sorry? Mm. Say again?
You cut out for... I didn't say anything. You cut out for a couple of seconds there. Sorry, I just lost you just for a couple of seconds.
Yeah, Team America World Police was funny because First of all, it was well written. That's the first thing to say. But secondly, it knew what it wanted to be, and it leaned into it, and it embraced its filthy, squalid nastiness. But
yep.
Happy Time Murders, they do that one scene of filth, which is, it's moderately funny, but it's not as funny as World Team America was. And then that's it. Yep. It goes back to being this sort of like low-level spoof of 1950s Humphrey Bogart.
Yes.
Private Eye films, and it never follows through except for one very brief moment that references Sharon Stone. It doesn't really quite own what it is, and that's why it fails so miserably.
Yeah. No, that's right. It seems to think that just by having the characters use profanity a lot, and some of the murders are a little gruesome. That somehow turns it into some sort of zany, wacky comedy.
Yes.
But that sits alongside, and particularly actually the Phil Phillips character, as played by Bill Beretta, I found his character was much more the serious one in the film, and it was trying to sort of dip into a well of pathos to sort of draw out the prejudice that puppets feel. And it just didn't work alongside the comedy. It really was trying to be two things at the same time. It dragged terribly, in my opinion. And and it's not that there weren't some good performances. I thought there was there's an actress, Maya Rudolph, played Bubbles, the secretary to, and I thought that was quite a nice little performance. I hate to say this, I think Melissa McCarthy is kind of just the same person in every film she's in, and I think she's losing that comedic edge, or maybe it's just familiarity is creeping in, but I'm not sure where she's going to go.
I'm increasingly thinking Bridesmaids was a fluke.
Well, yes, I mean, she was... Yeah, well, you wonder, don't you? Yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
By the way...
She's so one-note in this, isn't she?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, yep. Do you know, there was a film in the last few months, Phil, on Netflix called Bright...
Oh yeah.
It was a film made for Netflix. It had Will Smith, and it was almost exactly the same premise. It was a police drama set in an American city, but rather than puppets, there were orcs.
Oh.
And Will Smith had an orc partner.
Oh dear.
It was all about the prejudice. And I thought, is this a bit of a common, there's a little bit of a little theme emerging here of trying to put different species in as if to try to make a point about prejudice and racism, but... Yeah, I think that's going to extreme lengths to make that point. And I feel so sorry for Jim Henson. It was written by a guy called Todd Berger.
Yes.
He's only 39. And I had a quick look to see what other films he's been involved in the writing of. One of them is called It's a Disaster.
You should not be calling your film that, should you?
No. And another film he was involved in producing or writing was The Smurfs, A Christmas Carol. Now, I guess we all have to start somewhere. I know, and he's a young guy still, but I think the writing that let the film down, it just, flat as a pancake.
Well, Citizen Kane, they ain't.
No. Here's an interesting little thing. You saw this film, I think, Steve, not long after it arrived at the cinemas. Do you recall?
It was quite early on, yes.
Well, I didn't get to see it straight away. I think I got to see it during its second week of its opening. And I was struggling to find a cinema where I could go and see it. And in several cinemas in the central Auckland area, it was only on once a day.
Yeah.
And I managed just to get to one of those screenings. So it didn't last very long. It's completely bombed at the box office in America. And it's sad because here's the thing, Steve, the Muppets were very, very successful. And puppets can be very, very successful. There's something about that blank and passive face.
Yes.
That can allow someone watching it to imbue that face with their own emotions. And, it can be a really effective piece of way of telling a story. And that's the great tragedy of this. It didn't do that.
Well, I think, to be fair, that's kind of what we both said at the very start of this review, is there was so much potential in there that was just, wasted.
Yeah. Shame.
Let's just rub the salt in the wound a little bit, shall we?
All right.
It's grossed... 21 million. That's in the US. Worldwide, 24 million against a production budget of around 40. Damn well serves him right.
Damn well, it does. Anyway. I think we should at least say about that. I was going to say we shouldn't buy a ticket, but I think it's left the cinema already. So that there you are. You can't even see it anymore, I suspect.
I think that's all the review that film needs, really, isn't it? Yes. Right, then. So we'll tell you what. I mean, that's enough to make us want to leave the cinema, really, isn't it? So let's talk about music, shall we? And Simon, you've been talking to a musician, who's had a long career. He's sold a bucket load of albums, and he's played more than his fair share of live shows, and yet we've never heard of him.
No, I have to say, in all honesty, I had not heard of Stephen Wilson. And I guess I'm never been a big fan of what's called progressive rock, and that might be one of the reasons why. But he's an English guy. He's got a dedicated following. He's actually toured in New Zealand before, just a couple of years ago. He's coming back to Auckland's Bruce Mason Theatre on November the 12th for just a single show. And he's an interesting guy. Apart from his career in music, he's got some interesting thoughts about religion and politics and social media and even why he plays barefoot. So I caught up with him on the phone from the UK, and I found him an interesting chap to talk to, very articulate guy, a deep thinker about music and his craft. And here's some of my chat.
Is that Stephen?
Speaking.
Hi, Stephen. This is Simon Mercep speaking. I'm with an entertainment review podcast and website in Auckland called Crave. Thank you very much for talking to me today.
My pleasure, Simon. Nice to speak. I think we've spoken before, haven't we?
Ooh, I have worked on the radio and broadcasting in New Zealand, but I don't know if I've spoken with you before. But I do want to find out about this visit of yours to New Zealand, Stephen. Can I start with the show that you're doing in Auckland later this year? I think it's at the Bruce Mason Theatre. It's on November the 12th. Without giving too much away and not spoiling any surprises, what sort of evening's entertainment can the people who go along expect from Stephen Wilson?
Well, I always think about the shows pretty much the same way I think about the albums, which is that I like to treat it as an opportunity to take the listener or the concert attendee, in this case, on some kind of journey. So it's a very immersive show. It has a lot of visual elements to it, as well as the musical elements. There's quadraphonic sound system. There's a lot of films, projections, kind of enhancing the themes behind the songs. So it's a very, I would say, very spectacular, very immersive experience. And it's really, trying to take the listener on some kind of, musical journey, audiovisual journey or experience. And I really feel on this particular tour, I don't know if anyone's seen me before, but if they have, they'll know that I've always that's always been my goal. But certainly I think on this particular tour, I've definitely raised the bar and tried to, to make it even more impressive than ever before. So, the word that I keep coming back to is it's a very spectacular evening, I think.
I'm sure it will be. I'm going to come on to ask you about the music shortly, but just on the visual side before that, how involved are you in the design of the visuals that people see?
Well, I'm involved a lot, obviously, in the sense that all of the visuals kind of spring from the themes behind the songs, the lyrics. So the first thing I do, I work with two visual people. One of them is an animator and the other is a live action filmmaker. And in both cases, I sit down with them and I kind of go through the songs and I go through the lyrics and I kind of explain to them what I see in my mind, because I have a very strong kind of idea in my head about how these songs would, be interpreted visually. But of course, I don't have the talent, anywhere near the talent, to realize them myself. So I have to sit down and kind of explain and get across my ideas to these people. So in that sense, the kind of visual realizations of the songs is something that very much springs from the subject matter and the lyrics and the themes behind the songs. Of course, there's also a very, very strong signature of the filmmakers themselves, and in that sense, when I see the final pieces, I'm as much surprised as anyone else is, by the results,
Well, you've mentioned the themes a couple of times. Let's get on to that, if we may. You've been around for a little while now. You've got quite a body of work to draw on. Is there a particular theme that you are following in this latest show?
Yeah, so the new album, To the Bone, is very much themed around the idea of truth as perception. In other words, this concept that human beings have are called truth is very often nothing of the sort. It's all perception. So your truth is very different to my truth, is different to everyone else's truth. And truth is something that is filtered through our upbringing, our religion, our gender, our politics, our geography. All of these things kind of are filters for what we call truth. And in fact, a lot of the time what we call truth is of course, it's perception, it's not truth. And it got me thinking, really, is there any such thing as truth? Is it possible to have a definitive singular reality, a singular truth, when there is all this perception and all of this kind of, all of these agendas that we all have, and we kind of filter the world and our perception of the world through? So a lot of the album is about that. It can be about just two people in a relationship and how they kind of approach the relationship and see the relationship in completely different ways. Or it can be on a much broader scale, the worlds of politics. So there are songs about the refugee crisis. There are songs about terrorism. There are songs about all sorts of things on the record. So the show is very much geared to that particular subject matter.
Yeah.
And one thing I found over the years is when I write a new album, there are always songs from my back catalogue that seem to resonate very well with the newer material. And I suppose in a way that's an indication that songwriters like myself, we kind of have things that we come back to time and time again through our careers, certain themes which interest us.
Yeah.
And I find that when I go through my back catalogue, there are songs that fit very well with the newer To the Bone material. So there are some of those songs coming in, songs as much as 20 years into my back catalogue. And I guess the rest of it is just kind of whim, songs I feel like I want to play from my previous bands in some cases, or from my back catalogue. And it's all about creating that very satisfying sense of journey and narrative throughout the show, so that you're not allowing the audience to, hopefully not allowing the audience to lose concentration. So there's always something new popping up all the time.
Yeah, and I think it's a 3.5-hour show, so it's quite a long journey to take people on.
Yeah, there's about half an hour interval in the middle of the
Okay.
evening, but it's still a lot of music for people to digest. And so I think it's really a question of trying to make a 3-hour show seem like it's passed in a jiffy, and I think that's all about the sequencing and the selection process. And it's something I've worked very hard on over the years, not just with the live show, but also with the albums themselves.
Sure. I have to ask a very obvious question. Forgive me, Stephen. You've probably been asked this a million times, but when you were talking about the issue of truth, everyone around the world at the moment could not help but think about terms like fake news and alternative facts that the current American administration employs. Was the politics of the day all in your mind when you were brewing up To the Bone?
Yeah, of course. And I think probably that's where it originally came from, this idea that we now live in a world of the social media and the way that politicians are now beginning to manipulate social media to win elections, and of course that's been going on for a long time, but I think that we live now very much in a world where it's very hard to know what is real and what is fake. And so I think that's partly fed into this idea of really questioning the whole concept of truth at all. Does it exist? Everyone has their own agenda. Everyone, has their own perception. And I think you see that most explicitly, kind of demonstrated in modern politics, for sure.
I note in a few interviews in recent times, there was one in the BBC I was looking at the other day where the presenter introduced you as the most successful musician you've never heard of, which perhaps goes to someone who's not chasing celebrity in its own right, but has some other desires in mind. Can you tell me a bit about that? How caught up are you in the idea of a musician being a celebrity?
Well, you know, I would be, first thing I have to come clean, and I would say I would be lying if I didn't say I would like to be more known and I would like to be more successful, because of course I would, you know, anyone that, or not anyone, but most people I would say that create music or create film or painting, whatever it is they do creatively, ultimately they want to reach as many people as possible with that. They want to share that with as many people as possible. And one of the means you have to do that is through, obviously, you know, being being part of popular mainstream culture.
Yeah.
And you have an instantly large audience if you achieve that kind of status as being a popular icon. Now, I've never achieved that. And I have to say, it wasn't through want of trying. I have tried. I have tried to get songs on the radio. I've tried to promote myself. I've tried to become someone that is much better known than I am. Not because I want to be a celebrity, not because I want to make lots of money, but because I understand that's one of the mechanisms I might use to reach more people with my music. Now, for whatever reason, I've never been able to achieve that. So I've kind of resigned myself to the fact that I am, in many respects, that kind of quintessential cult artist. And that's really, listen, there's no shame in that.
No, there isn't.
There's something to be very proud of about that, too. It means the people that listen to my music have found me in a very kind of organic way. They found, you know, either through personal recommendation, whatever it is. But the people who discover me and become my fans are not people that are, let's just say, they're not the kind of fickle audience that are going to move on to the next popular, mainstream act.
Right.
They kind of stay with me because of that. So I recognize that there are definitely pros and cons. And that's really what, you know, that phrase, the most popular artist you've never heard of, what that was kind of trying to say was, here's an artist who has, you know, a substantial fan base, but is actually pretty invisible in the mainstream.
How much of that? How much of that, Stephen, is to do with? And forgive me, I'm going to use a label which is so easy to toss around. You're often associated with progressive rock or prog rock, which,
yes,
perhaps for many people, it brings to mind a type of music that is a bit more reflective, that maybe is a longer form piece of music that may not be so commercially accessible. So, to a certain extent, I'm just wondering whether that the genre of music you've been dealing with of itself may only appeal to a dedicated, perhaps smaller audience.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. I think it is partly because of the musical connections that people sort of make when they hear my name. But the one thing I would disagree with is that this idea that particular type of music has a kind of cutoff point in terms of the kind of audience that you can reach. And I only have to point to one of the most successful albums in history, Dark Side of the Moon.
Absolutely.
To kind of prove you wrong on that. And I think, you know, listen, I'm not comparing myself to a great art band like Pink Floyd, but one thing I would say is that I don't think my music is particularly what you might call difficult. I think if you give it a chance, it's very melodic. And in the same way, the Dark Side of the Moon is very, very intellectual, very conceptual. It's also very accessible.
Yeah.
And I think if I have anything in common with that kind of music, it would be closer to that kind of record rather than, say, Emerson, Lake and Palmer or something like that. So I think my music is quite accessible. You're right that I have tended to be labeled as progressive rock, but you only have to listen to my records to realize there's a lot more going on than just progressive rock. There are pure moments of pop. There are singer-songwriter ballads. There are moments of ambient music, almost industrial music, electronic music. There's all these things going on. But I think you're absolutely right. I think what happens with the media is that once they've decided what box you kind of belong into, then they're very reluctant to see you in any other way. And I certainly have struggled against that perception.
Well, that brings me to an interesting point, because I was looking at, as you can these days, go on YouTube and you can find all manner of material there. And the songs and the videos that accompany the singles that have been released from the new album To the Bone, songs like Pariah and The Song of I and Permanating, they're quite, first of all, they're not long, long songs. They're kind of songs you'd hear on the radio, and they're very as you say, melodic, catchy, and visually interesting. And you, Stephen Wilson, feature very prominently in them. So those songs, although the themes may be serious, the presentation has a very pop sort of feel to it. Would that be fair?
I think you're right. Yeah, I mean, listen, I've loved pop music since I was a kid. You know, I grew up, my hero when I was a teenager was Prince. And Prince was at his absolute peak in the 80s when I was a teenager. And to me, he was like the ultimate artist. This is a guy that was a pop star in the true sense of the word, in the way that, you know, in the way that David Bowie has been in the 70s, you know, Prince was in the 80s, this incredible icon, this fashion, you know, dressed great, danced great, played great, sang great, wrote great songs. And I wanted to be Prince. So there's always been a little part of me that's always wanted to be a quote unquote pop star, you know, and I'd be the first to admit that. So I've never been particularly one that's been interested in hiding behind the sort of conceptual side of the music. I think sometimes it's actually much better if music has a very strong personality and a very kind of forthright personality behind it. Now, of course, there are examples of bands that never had that, and Pink Floyd, Radiohead, they've kind of, you know, in a way they kind of turned their back on the cult of personality. But I've always liked it, you know, growing up with people like Prince and Bowie. I've loved kind of, you know, that the fact that they did have very strong personalities and very strong identities. And you can tell that I like to talk as well, you know. So I have a lot of opinions, and I have a very distinctive, I think, very distinctive kind of view of the industry I'm in and the world I live in. And I'm not afraid to kind of put that forward. So I think, again, people that listen to my music are also, in a way, they're kind of they're getting into that, you know, cult, if you like, that stems, cult is the wrong word, but you know what I'm trying to say?
Yeah.
The kind of aesthetics that stem from my personality, my viewpoints on the world. And you'll notice also that a lot of my lyrics are about the world that we live in. They're not about things like sci-fi or, you know, space and all that stuff. Yeah. They're very much about this world that we're all a part of.
Is there a danger for any artist in putting their view forward that they can be, you know, there could be a tendency to preaching and perhaps alienating people who want to come along and just enjoy a piece of music and be entertained? Is there a fine line there?
I think very much so. And you've used the word fine line. I think it is a question about finding a balance, because an artist that has no... is kind of blank. There's nothing there to grasp onto. But at the same time, I'm not a fan of telling your audience who they should vote for, how they should think, how they should live their lives. I think what's really fundamental to my music is I feel like sometimes the songs that I write are written from a very personal perspective. They do express strong opinions about what I think and the world I live in and the way I view it. But to me, it's like holding up a mirror. And you basically hold up that mirror and you say to the audience, do you recognize yourself? Do you agree with what is, you know, the ideas being put forward in these songs? And I think that's, to me, that's the balance. It's like presenting an opinion, but not necessarily forcing it on other people. Now, for example, I'm a very strong vegetarian, but I don't go out of my way to tell my audience that they should all be vegetarians. No. I tell them I'm a vegetarian.
Yes.
I tell them I'm a vegetarian. I tell them why I'm a vegetarian. And that's as far as I go. Mm. So at that point, I let them draw their own conclusions. And I think that's, personally, that's the way I feel most comfortable about going about it.
Yeah. I think, again, just looking at a few videos of you on the internet, Stephen, you seem a very comfortable performer on stage and chatting to your audience. And I'm...
Yeah.
Where does that come from? Because they often think of artists who can, you know, be so involved in the creative internal processes that go on in the writing and the crafting in the studio, and that's quite a different job than the job of being in front of people and performing live. How do those two things sit together for you?
Yeah, it's been strange how I've arrived at that. I mean, it's a funny thing because I was never really, even though Prince was my idol as a kid, I was a very shy kid and I never felt that comfortable when I was initially thrust into the sort of role of being a front man with my previous band, Porcupine Tree. And I had to learn in a way as I went along how to be a front man. I've been doing it for 20 plus years now. And one thing I found almost by accident was that any kind of artifice or any kind of, you know, scripted kind of like interaction with the audience always struck me as really uncomfortable and really fake. And I just find that what works for me is just talking to the audience like I'm talking to a friend in the pub. And now that seems like a very odd thing to do. Like if you're playing the Royal Albert Hall to 5,000 people, how can you talk to someone as if you... But somehow I've kind of arrived at this very kind of chatty, informal style. And people seem to, again, engage with that and they like that. And again, it's very much a part, it's an extension of my personality. And I'm always, you know, I'm kind of disappointed when I go along and see artists I like and you know, all you really get from them in between is like, thank you very much. It's lovely to be here. This song is called, you know, because, of course, the songs themselves are telling you a lot about that person.
Yes.
At least they should be. So why shouldn't that person also that kind of be reflected in the way they communicate with the audience between the songs? So sometimes I'm ashamed to say my introductions to the songs go on longer than the songs do, you know.
Just as a counterpoint to that, we had a week or two ago in Auckland, Stephen Bob Dylan played. He did not utter one word in the whole concert. He just came on, played a song, played another song, didn't say good evening, didn't say good night, and that was that. So every artist has their own way of presenting their work.
Yeah, I mean, that, you know, that's another way of doing it, isn't it? Complete blankness. I mean, just letting the music do.
Yeah.
And there's something to be said for that. Just letting the music do the talking, you know. Yeah. But it doesn't work for me.
Yeah.
I feel like I want to engage with the audience. I really value my audience, and I understand every single one of them. Well, you know, not every single one of them, but almost everyone there has discovered the music, like I said earlier, through some way that has nothing to do with hype and nothing to do with, you know, the music having been forced on them. They found it, they've fallen in love with it, and they've come to the show and they feel like they're part of some kind of exclusive kind of club, you know, in a way, of which I'm the host. And,
yes.
I really enjoy that stuff. It doesn't always work. Sometimes I'm kind of talking on stage and cracking jokes and, you know, it's just not going down very well at all, you know, and people say, get on with the show, you know.
But generally speaking,
I think people really like it and they feel like, you know, it's all part of my world, you know.
Yeah. Okay, well, we're nearly out of time here, but just one last question. Are you going to wear shoes on stage?
No, I haven't worn shoes on stage. I don't think I've done a show with shoes on in 30 years, so I'm not about to start.
And why is that?
Well, you know, in some ways, it seems like a kind of frivolous or trivial thing, but it actually comes from the same place as everything else we've talked about, is that there's no artifice. Now, the thing is, I always felt more comfortable when I was a kid growing up. I was always running around without shoes, you know. And I've always felt more comfortable without shoes. And the one place I want to feel the most comfortable of all, of course, is when I'm on stage in front of an audience. I want to feel comfortable. I don't want anything to distract me. So it didn't seem like I was making any grand statement. It was just a very natural thing that I felt more comfortable without shoes off stage. Therefore, I feel more comfortable on stage. And again, it's something I've not really thought about, and I think people just accept it. It's my thing, you know.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, Stephen, thank you so much. Really enjoyed talking to you, and wish you all the best for the show in Auckland. I'll just remind everyone, it's on November the 12th. It's at the Bruce Mason Theatre in Auckland. I think it's the only New Zealand show you're having. Thank you for talking to Crave, and I think people who go along are going to be wonderfully entertained. It sounds fantastic. Thank you.
I really hope so. Nice to speak to Simon. Cheers, mate.
So that's Stephen Wilson on the line from the UK. Due here in Auckland, just one show at Auckland's Bruce Mason Theatre, November the 12th. Should be an interesting performance. Not your typical sort of rock star. He's got long, straight hair and glasses. Plays barefoot on stage. A thinking person's musician, a performer, I think, rather than a sort of a sex symbol type performer. I think that would be a fair way.
Sounds good something. To me.
Yeah. And by the way, the whole interview will be on our website, cravepodcast.com. Now, Mr. McCabe,
Mr. Mercer,
that concert is still to come, but you've been to a concert just recently, which, by all accounts, was very much a spectacular with a capital S. Tell us about Pink.
Well, here's the thing. Last time we spoke, I had a few harsh words to say about Katy Perry.
I do recall.
And I'm going to revisit that for a reason. When I saw Katy Perry... I'm not a fan of the kind of music that the two women, and yes, they are different, they are quite different, but it's more so that the high energy modern pop music that is definitely popular at the moment, it's not really my thing, to be perfectly honest. I went to Katy Perry, not expecting great things, and I wasn't disappointed. She was rubbish. I think I talked about this at great length last time. And everyone said it was going to be this fantastic, spectacular show. And basically, it felt like the fever dream of an art school dropout. And it was poo.
Okay.
And that was kind of in the back of my mind when I showed up at Spark Arena last week for Pink. I was thinking we're going to have basically the same kind of nonsense again. It's going to be energetic pop with overblown costumes. I'm going to be bored out of my little mind. And so in I went, and we started off. We had an opening act from Australia who I've seen before, the Rubens, who opened a few years ago for Imagine Dragons. And unfortunately, while I do like their music, they're still very much an opening act. And I have hopes for them that one day they'll break out, but yeah, they don't quite seem there yet. So off they went, and on came a DJ to keep the crowd warm up.
And okay.
I do wonder if this is really, you know, much in the way of an opening act, because he's basically just playing other folks' records. But the thing that I liked about him was he's an American fellow, but he'd clearly done his research. He knew where he was. Because, I mean, obviously he played Lord. Because, you know...
Yes, as you would, yes.
I'm in New Zealand, I'll play Lord. And obviously, you know, you can't go far on with Royals. He played Dave Dobbin.
Oh, did he? Oh,
yeah, he actually played Slice of Heaven. I thought, okay, this guy knows his audience. So I was impressed. I mean, a lot of the pre-show music, there was The Knack and Def Leppard and AC/DC and Aerosmith. And, you know, I mean, there was like, old music. It was my music. So, you know, I was thinking, okay, they're catering not just for the children in the audience. So that was starting to be a bit more warmed. And there were no adverts for any products made by Pink.
Well, that's a relief.
That was a step up from what Miss Perry had managed. So on she came. And the show was bonkers. It really was. It was the same kind of grossly, massively overblown set production. But somehow it worked in a way that Perry's show didn't. It was coherent. It was entertaining. I'm not a big fan of the music. I'm never going to be. But I was a fan of the way she put her show together. I'm trying to think how to explain. She's got the same dozen backing dancers that... are there to support the performance, but somehow they managed to stand back and showcase Pink, who got to be the star of her show. Katy Perry got lost on stage at some points, lost in the middle of the production. I felt like Pink, the show was about her, and it supported her and allowed her to excel. So she's got a very strong voice.
Yeah,
she does faithful renditions of all the songs you'd expect. So she comes on stage and opens with "Let's Get This Party Started," which is the obvious song for her to open with. But halfway through, she played "Smells Like Teen Spirit" by Nirvana.
Okay,
and she sang it well.
Okay,
it was angry and it was nasty and it was everything that song needs to be. And I'm thinking, like this. And I've never seen anything as many things fly in a concert as they did at this show.
And any objects in the air,
anything that could be attached to a wire and strung up into the rafters was. And it was almost like watching Cirque du Bloody Soleil, but it was done well. I was I can't keep stressing this strongly enough, that everything that Katy Perry did that was just overdone and too much and self-indulgent and pointless and unfocused was done right by Pink. It was an entertaining, well-done, powerful production. And no, I'm never going to walk away being a fan of Pink. I'm too old. It's not my taste. But I tell you what, I could see what the fuss was all about.
Yeah. Sounds like she's a person who's got, this is a terribly cliched thing to say, but a lot of character, and that comes through in her performance. I mean, you know, she's not a false person. She sounds like she's a genuine person.
Very much so. In fact, toward the end, during the costume changes, I think there were three costume changes, four acts the show was built into. So there's three intermissions where they play videos. One of them was a little bit dodgy. Something about Revenge Land was with sort of ill-conceived video in it. But the last costume change video, there was a little speech about how she was telling her daughter, it's not always about if people think you're pretty or not, it's whether or not you actually work hard and have got confidence and make the most of your unique inbuilt potential. You know, it's one of those sort of typically heartwarming, self-affirming American everything's wonderful if you work hard kind of affirmations. But somehow she made it not cheesy, which is not an easy thing to do.
No, it's not, no.
And then when she came out on stage, she brought her daughter out with her, which, again, could have been sick-inducing, but wasn't.
Okay, well, that's quite something to pull off. Okay.
It is. I'll say it again. Not a fan of the music, never going to be a fan, but I walked away understanding why people are.
Just one final question to you, because I remember not that long before the shows in New Zealand, Steve, there was a news item that she'd had to cancel one show overseas because of some throat problems. But you said earlier that she was singing well.
It was over in Sydney, so not that long ago, not that far ago. No. She had to reschedule shows because she really wasn't well. And I tell you, you'd never have guessed. I mean, the woman's got phenomenal strength and energy. At one point, one of her backing dancers, I should say, was hanging from a harness. So he was hanging horizontally. And her foot, just her foot, was clamped between her thighs. His thighs, I beg your pardon. Ooh. And she was hanging from her foot, which he was supporting just between his legs, and she was singing.
Gosh.
For the encore, she was put in a little harness that had her basically Peter Panning around the audience, upside down, back to front, you name it, all over the damn place. I would have probably got car sick doing it. And she didn't miss a beat as she sang.
Wow.
Oh, yeah.
And she was definitely singing. There was no lip syncing going on. So
well, to be fair, she was moving so fast you couldn't tell that for certain. But no, it sounded real. It sounded very, very authentic. I'm
sure it was. Wow, that's well impressed. Wow. Well, if she comes back, I might have to.
I'd go again. You know? I'd go again.
Yeah. Wow.
For a minute to feel like it.
Okay, fantastic. Pink at Auckland Splack Arena. Hey, Steve, what about other shows coming up? I think you've been putting one or two items on our web page about concerts. What have we got to look forward to over the next week or two or three?
Couple of things. I mean, there's a couple of names you might not be that familiar with, Simon. Snarky Puppy are a sort of an art rock band from the US. Not the easiest band in the world to describe, but they sound quite interesting. April the 15th at the Power Station in Auckland, April 16th at the Opera House in Wellington. That could be worth a look. What else have we got? Taylor Swift has announced her support acts, and one of them's a Kiwi band.
Oh,
Broods.
Okay.
Broods.
Oh, yes, yep.
And she's also got Charlie XCX from England, who I saw opening for CL last year, was quite impressed with. More Australian bands. We've got the Red Hot Summer Tour. It's going to feature Jimmy Barnes. There's a good Australian name.
Yes.
And the Angels and Diesel and the current big Australian band, The Living End. But we have no great interest in them because they're only playing in Lower Hutt.
Okay. Also, that's of course, our listenership on Crave is so widespread that there'll be some people down there who'll be delighted to hear about that, I'm sure.
Very definitely.
Yes.
We have a save the date.
Yes.
10th anniversary of the Laneway Festival in Auckland.
Okay.
It's going to be held in Auckland. Where are we looking? Loads of dates here, but Auckland is Monday the 28th of January.
Okay.
Now, that was quite an amazing day out last year.
I remember you telling me how much you enjoyed it. Yeah,
that was cool. So it's good. That's Auckland anniversary day, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right. Yes.
And then the one big pop name that's coming to town is Lily Allen.
Okay. Lily Allen. Yes.
Yeah, I thought you were. Yeah. And she's going to be at Spark Arena on Saturday, the 2nd of February. So just after Laneway. And of course, the big show that's coming up very shortly, you won't want to miss this, obviously, 21st of September. So that's next week. Spark Arena will play host to Cher.
Ah. Yeah, I think she'll be a huge crowd. I reckon she will. She will just be so. There'll be such a high curiosity factor.
Yes, I think it's a curiosity factor.
And that latest Mamma Mia movie was so classic.
Yes.
Ah, hey, by the way, just one thing that's happened since we last. Yeah, great. Hey, one thing that's happened since you and I last spoke on a podcast, Steve, is that on American television, on the Ellen Daily Show, the new Fleetwood
Mac. I know where you're going with this. Yeah.
Mac lineup with New Zealand's Neil Finn and Mike Campbell, ex Heartbreakers, played a couple of songs live, and Neil Finn took the lead vocals on The Chain. Did a bloody good job, I thought.
Oh yeah.
So that was really interesting.
I mean, it's an amazing song to begin with. So, yeah. That was. I saw the video of that myself. It's worth a look, isn't it?
It is, and I don't think there have been any details announced yet, but you'd think that Neil Finn would be moving heaven and earth to get them to come here to do at least one show, if not more, in our good.
If they don't make it to New Zealand, then frankly, the Aussies.
I'm hoping.
If they don't come to New Zealand, then the Aussies can have him back.
Ooh, harsh words. Anyway. I'm not quite sure if I can go that far, but I think he'll come. He'll come. Anyway, look, hey, thanks for listening to Steve and I this week. We've had a good old yarn about movies and music. And if you want to sort of catch up with some of our written reviews and see some of the notices that Steve's been talking about, acts coming up, and also get some look at some really nice concert photography that Steve is providing,
you're very good.
Go to our website. Yeah, I'm not sure. It's cravepodcast.com.
And you can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Twitter at Crave Podcast.
A cunningly devised Twitter handle, if ever there was one.
I know.
When
does that start? you can also email us. We'd love to hear what you've got to say about any of the things we've talked about today. You can reach us on our email address, podcast@cravepodcast.com.
Yes, we are tuned in. Anyway, I'm Simon Mercer.
I'm Steve McCabe.
And that's what's been entertaining us this week.